Last year, or last month, or last week, I should say, we had a pretty good show. We had lots of callers, and we had lots of different things. Hey, Gil, tap your mic for me so that I can make sure that, perfect. See, I'm learning this new board still. I make mistakes, and I really should know better. Nevertheless, from last week, I did capture, and let me mute my inside speakers because you're probably getting a echo there.
Yeah, I'm getting feedback. There's a volume button that's on too.
Okay, I got you. How about now?
Am I better
now? Okay, well, that's because I had to mute the stereo speakers and I didn't know they were on because my headphones are on. So, but it's all my fault. Anyway, I got some really interesting email, and I thought I'd share them with you. A guy sends me an email and he says, "Hey, I went to a shop and they wanted to do some fuel injector and fuel system cleaning for $189.95. What do you think about that?" And my answer to him was, I don't own that equipment. I have no intention of buying that equipment. That service doesn't appear in your owner's manual, but it is a valid service if you're going to use it as a diagnostic process. If you're going to use it as a diagnostic process, and if you're going to use it as something that you're supposed to use to determine, for instance, I'll give you a good example. You have an intermittent miss, and it's not the spark plugs because they're new. It's not the wires, and we don't really know if it's a fuel injector or not. Dan, you got 150,000 miles on your car, so it might be appropriate to flush the fuel injectors, because after the end of the flush, one of three things are going to happen: better, worse, or the same. So that would be an important thing to have, but not at $189. Now, I think you can Google fuel injection service, fuel injector flush, and you can find that anywhere from $39 up to, that's the highest I've ever seen it, is $189.95. But it's up to you, folks. It's up to you to decide. But I want to arm you with this. When you're approached by any shop and they say, you know, you need a fuel injection flush, you haven't had one according to our records, you have too many miles, or based on our mileage intervals, you're due for one, I think the appropriate response is what symptom do I have today that you're going to fix with this $190 flush? That is a very good question. And I want to tell you something. I'm willing to bet you at a lunch at McDonald's that you're going to hear 90% of the people on the other end of the line just start stuttering and spewing their part of the conversation that makes no sense whatsoever, because that's a very tough question to answer. Now, the appropriate answer would be related to your symptoms. Mrs. Jones, I'm wondering if it runs good in the morning when it's cold, and do you have an uneven idle and a kind of a da-da-da-da-da acceleration, and then it seems after it warms up it's fine, and if you do, I want to see if I can eliminate that or change it, either better or worse, because that's going to be a good thing. If it's better, then we might do it again. Or you may say, it's so much better, I'm happy where it's at. If it's worse, we still know what we know, and that is we only flush the fuel injectors, and it's worse today. So we made it worse, but the diagnostic process told us exactly. So now we're going to pull the spark plugs and look at the color of the spark plugs, and that'll tell us which cylinder is probably messing up. Or we're going to keep your car overnight and hook our scanner to it and find out which cylinder is not contributing the next morning. So that's just information for you. It's up to you to decide, because it's your money to spend. I had a gentleman call me and he says, you know, I'm new to the area and I'm scared to death of your summers. And of course, it's what was 120 yesterday. He says, I want to know what kind of battery I should buy for my car. And I write him back and I say to him, a better question is, what battery do you have in your truck, Mark? What battery do you sell? What battery do you have in your kids' cars and your shop trucks and your parts delivery vehicles and your shuttle van? What kind of? And the answer is AC Delco. We sell AC Delco. for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's a name brand, so the warranty is going to be readily taken care of by just about anybody or any small town you're going to fail in. Number two, it's a very clean battery. And unfortunately, if you get a low-maintenance battery or if you get what we call a gasser, a battery that's going to gas a lot, then you end up having to buy cables and the hold-down brackets and the tray the battery sits on a regular basis because the battery gasses so bad and the acid eats everything within 5 inches of the battery. And Delcos just don't do that. Now, it is true that years and years ago, Delco had a real problem with the cables or the terminals coming loose from the side post batteries, and then that would allow acid to leak out of the positive or the negative post and down on your tray and eat up your tray. Delco stood up and said, we'll take care of a lot of those, providing you can provide documentation where you bought the battery and when it was actually installed. So if you bought the battery 3 days ago and the tray's been eaten up, you know, rather severely, then there's not a relationship to 3 days ago to this tray being eaten up that's going to take months and months and months. But on the other hand, if the battery's been in there 2 years and the tray's all eaten up and there's a stain off of one of the terminals on the side post battery and there's acid coming out of it, then one and one equals two. That's not a problem. That's not a hard problem to come to a conclusion on. So we sell Delco. You're welcome to buy whatever battery you want. But I'll also tell you something about a battery that kind of concerns me. There is more than one road service companies out there that are stocking and selling batteries to you, and it's become a huge profit center. So I'm in Payson, and my wife and I come out of the Basha store, and we got some groceries. She's got, you know, I don't know, 5 cases of beer, and I've got a gallon of milk. And the lady next to where we parked is kind of in stress, you could tell. And I said to her, is there anything I can help you with? Did you lock your keys in your car? And she says, no, my car won't start. And I said, I'm happy to help you if you'd like. And she says, well, I've called for help. And I said, okay. And she says, but, you know, what can you do? And I said, well, I'd like to just see if it's a bad connection. And what I'd like to do is, if you'd pop your hood, I'm going to ask you to turn on your headlights, and probably the headlights won't shine. And then I'm going to kind of wiggle the cable to see if I can get the headlights to shine, because I promise you, if I can get the headlights to shine, this car will start. And then you can deal with it later. You can have somebody clean the cables. And she says, okay. So she gets in her car, and I start wiggling the negative post, but both the posts are clean. And then I wiggle the positive post, and the headlights go in and out. So it's not a dirty cable. The positive post has become disconnected from the internal portions of the batteries. So I said, okay, well, we'll wait. I don't have jumper cables, ma'am, but we'll wait till the tow truck gets here. So the tow truck guy gets there, and he has his portable jump box. And, folks, the portable jump box has an on and off switch. So you're supposed to turn it off when you hook the battery up so that there's no spark, hence an explosion, because a spark over the top of a battery 50% of the times causes the battery to explode, and it's a sound that will make your eardrums hurt. Plus, it covers you in battery acid, and you better hope somebody's got a hose close by. So I see him hook up the thing, but I don't see him turn it on. But again, maybe he already had it on. So I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. So she hits the key and nothing happens. Then he reaches up and he turns the switch, but I can't tell if he's turning it on or off. And he says, try it again. And she says, she knows and he knows and I know it's nothing. And I'm just sitting there kind of wondering what's going on. So anyway, it's none of my business. I get in my car. I bid her farewell. He's selling her a battery. She probably needed a battery, but I'm just wondering, did he jumpstart that properly? Could she have gone home and let her husband decide what to do? I don't know if he took away her options or not. I was just kind of concerned. And I wasn't born yesterday. I've been a mechanic for 37 years, and I'm a master mechanic, an ASE master technician. And I'm also a former policeman, so my eyes are focused on things that most people might not look at. So if you look at the big picture, I was bothered. And so I don't know if what I saw was wrong or right, but I want you to learn from that, that you need to watch what they're doing underneath your hood. And really and truly, folks, the headlights are the key. When you turn the headlights on and there's no headlights or there's yellow headlights, when they hook up whatever they're going to hook up, you better see white and bright. And as they wiggle the cables, you see white and bright. And when you see white and bright, that car will start. Now, it may not start without a jump start, but it's going to start now. Unless, of course, the starter's bad, and that makes something else completely different. So, nevertheless, 602-508-0960. And if we don't have any callers, we're going to start talking about tires and when they expire. And, of course, all the excuses I hear why I don't want to replace the tires that, you know, are 20 years old. 602-508-0960. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back, everybody. My name is Mark Salem, and for the next couple of hours, we're talking about car repair. You're welcome to join us anytime you want, 602-508-0960. As you know, I have a list of the best car repair shops in the valley, and I have them under transmission and mechanical, paint and body, and diesel. But I want to tell you about IMM Auto Service, which has been around since 1972. They've been on my list for years and years and years. And IMM Auto Service is a very important shop in my group because he's the only one that raises his hand and says, I'm really good on Volvos, Saabs, Fiats, and Alfa Romeos. Now, David at the IMM Auto Service, he can do your Toyota, your Honda, your Chevy, your Ford, your Chrysler. He can do anything that's in your garage, but the rest of us can't. In that respect that you have a Ford on one side of your garage, and on the other side you have a Volvo, Saab, Fiat, or Alfa Romeo, we can do an oil change. But when it comes to tracking down a problem, those cars are just weird. So if you live anywhere in the East Valley, they're just south of the 202, just west of the 101, kind of in the northeast corner of Tempe, IMM Auto Service. If you have one of those cars, you really need to get to know them so that if you need them, that you already have a relationship. And the way to open that relationship is stop by for an oil change, shake their hand, and now you've become a customer. Brian, good morning to you. How can I help you this morning?
Hey, Mark, this is Brian. I've got an 02 Goldwing Honda.
Okay.
And it's about 96,000 miles, and it sat for a long time, and it got that smell of, like, a dead car, like bad gas. And I've cleaned it up. I've been through, like, five tanks of gas, new air filter. I've sprayed some throttle body cleaner down it. And every now and then, when it sits for a while, that smell comes back. Where can I start looking to get rid of that?
Well, is there any other symptoms other than the smell?
No. It runs like a top.
Okay. Is it fuel injected or carbureted?
Fuel injected.
Okay. I'm not quite sure where the smell is coming from. I would think that maybe you could run it down to reserve and you know, as close as you can and get into reserve and then fill it up with fuel. You might also add a gasoline additive. Like something that's a cleaner, a detergent, something that will revitalize old gasoline. You might even add some Stabil to the tank, and in relationship to how many gallons that Goldwing holds, Stabil is something that we install in all of our hot rods that are going to sit for a long time, and it keeps the gas from varnishing up and stinking. It Stabil keeps the gasoline stable. The only other thing I can think of is if it's fuel injected and it's an O2, it probably, does it have catalytic converters in the exhaust system, or do you have an aftermarket exhaust system?
It's stock, and I wouldn't know. I don't know how to tell.
Because I don't know the answer to that either, but I can tell you that the catalytic converter will cause smells that you wouldn't otherwise have, because now it's going to burn the leftover fuel again. So if you've got some rancid fuel in that, then it might very well be that the motor's making it stink, but then the stink goes through the exhaust, and the fact that the cat's red hot and it's also burning that fuel up, then you're getting that smell. That's the only thing I can think of.
It happens when it sets for a few days, and it's more common when the tank is almost empty.
Okay. Well, you're going to have to vent the tank, otherwise you're sucking on a straw that's been pinched. So I would keep it full of fuel to see if that has a relationship. I would also put a little bit of a small amount of petroleum jelly on the rubber gas cap seal to make sure I've got a good seal there. But if you have no drivability problems and all you've got is the smell, I mean, have you gone on a 100-mile trip? Have you gone up to Payson and back lately?
No, I mean, it's not really. It's my dad's bike, and I just want to keep it going. And, I mean, like I said, five tanks of gas, about five tanks right now. It just still okay. comes back every now and then.
And your five tanks is probably going to be, it's probably a five-gallon tank, so you're probably in the 200 to 300-mile range each tank. So I would think that you right. probably are past that. You've had an oil change lately, right?
Right.
Okay. I you're asking me a question I've never run into before ever. If there's no question that old gas stinks, but for you to get it after we've already run it down to virtually nothing and filled it up a couple of times, I don't have an answer for you, but I've given you the best. I know that the options I've given you would be the ones I would try had I had your symptoms. Okay? Good luck to
Appreciate
you, Brian.
Your time.
You betcha. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. I also want to tell you with respect to batteries and stuff like that, it's really important to know that if you have a battery warranty and you buy a battery from a tow truck, they're going to take your old battery because there's a core charge that's associated, and it's normally $5 to $10. If your old battery has a warranty, you can't go back with your paperwork to your shop that you bought the battery from and ask them to warranty a battery that you don't have in your hand or you don't have in a box. Now that doesn't mean the shop, if you're a good, really good customer and the shop recognizes that there was a $44 credit on the old battery, that's not to say that they wouldn't do that, but they're not obligated to do it because they're not going to get reimbursed from the battery manufacturer because they don't have the battery. So that guy took the battery, and I can't tell you how many times it's the number is in excess of 50 where I've heard a shop owner complain that they took the battery out, put in a new one. I sent the customer back. They found the battery, and we know it's our battery because of this, and I tested it, and it's fine. So then I put the old battery back in, and the car's fine for 2 weeks. Now I take the new battery and go to get a credit on it, and there's no credit. Or it's something like this battery was a year old and they condemned it, but the cables were filthy dirty. So I cleaned up the cables on the new battery. Everything is fine, but I'm not sure that the testing was valid. So the big problem is the shop wants the old battery back. And they'll, most of the time, and I know I'll give you the core credit of $5 to $8. So if you're going to buy a battery from a tow truck operator, keep your old battery, especially if it's under warranty. Even if it's not under warranty and you're my customer, you just pay them the core charge and bring the battery to me. Here's why. It's not that I'm special, but there's always the risk that if, in fact, the battery's not bad and the tow truck driver knows it, he's not going to want you taking that old battery back. So there might be a little bit of backtracking, if you know what I mean, after you have that conversation. Now, that dovetails nicely into this. You always ask for your old parts back. And why do you do that? Well, number one, you'll be glad you asked for the old parts back, because if they sell you a mass airflow sensor, which is an electronic device that costs $500, and it doesn't fix your problem, you can go back to the shop and say, please, let's put my old one back on, give me a credit for the $500 new one, and let's move on from here. It did not fix my problem in any way, shape, or form, so I would prefer we put the old one back on. Now, if you don't ask for your old parts, you can't do that. I'll tell you a story that happened to me the other day. A customer came in and he said he wanted front shocks. Well, there's three parts to a front shock absorber. There's the upper mount, the shock absorber, and the spring. We didn't communicate properly, but he also didn't either. And when he came in, he was really mad, and he wanted all three parts, and we only replaced two parts. We didn't replace the spring. All hell broke loose. And so we said to him, we'll just put you back the way we found you. We'll put your old shocks back on. We'll put your old mounts back on, and we'll hand you the keys. We'll just back out of this deal quickly. Now, he had left and come back a couple of times, and I think we ultimately, at no charge to him, we ultimately put on complete shocks at our expense, and he hasn't been back since. But I still kept his old ones and the old parts, because if he does come back and I need to put him back on, I'm hanging on to him. So that's why the shop is telling you, that's why I'm telling you to insist that your shop give you oil parts. They're not going to give you your oil filter or your fuel filters, but they can give you your cabin filter, your air filter, your old spark plugs, your wires, your hoses, your belts. They can do that. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. Welcome back, everybody. 34 minutes after the hour of 10 o'clock. My name is Mark Salem. We're going to get to the phones right after this. Larry Harker's Auto Repair has been around since 1967. He's at 38th Avenue and Indian School. He's probably one of the best diagnosticians. Bob, by the way, he's in charge of the shop, and his wife, Helen, Ellen, is at the front counter. Bob is probably one of the best diagnosticians I've ever met. He has two things that separates him from the rest. He has a fundamental knowledge of how every aspect of the car works, and he has the tenacity to chase the problem down. So if you've got one of those problems that two or three other people haven't been able to solve, I think you should go to Larry Harker's Auto. But if you live near 38th Avenue and Indian School, I would strongly suggest you develop a relationship with Bob and Ellen at Larry Harker's Auto, 38th Avenue and Indian School. Steve, good morning to you. How can I help you?
Good morning, Mark. Always enjoy the show. You guys do a great service to those of us who aren't up to speed on all the new stuff. So
thank you. Thank you very much.
A couple of questions if we have the time.
Okay.
Number one, a 96 Ford Ranger. Car's getting old. I'm more concerned about the safety equipment, particularly the seat belts. I know a lot of stuff deteriorates in the sunlight out here. Does a seat belt deteriorate to the point where it ought to be replaced at some point?
I've never been answered that question, but I am involved in safety issues with respect to cars. I've been doing consulting work on car wrecks and that car automotive mechanical stuff since 1990. I've never heard anyone say that. Now, it is true that my company, my car repair shop, we replace retractors and seat belts maybe once or twice a year, but it's because they stop to function. So it's a replacement of a defective part. I've never had anybody ask me, nor in 37 years have I ever had anybody instruct me to replace their seat belts because of age, wear, and tear. However, if there's any portion of the belt that's frayed, then that could create a problem based on the weight and the speed of the vehicle and the accident that it's involved in. So the fraying is more than just where it goes through the D-ring on your shoulder. It's more than just a slight amount of fraying. We're talking about a fraying that's compromised some portion of the width of the belt. So other than that,
okay,
if they look good if they look good, I'd leave them alone.
Okay, well, they look okay. There's a little bit of edge fraying, you know, but it's like more like something you'd see on your sweater than something that compromises the belt. But I'm giving this car to my son, and I don't want to give him something that may cause a problem, you know?
You know, the only thing I would, one father to the other, I was adamant that if you didn't use safety devices, and I caught you doing, you know, not using safety devices, when my kids were younger, we had a Lexus come in that had been wrecked and had a bunch of kids inside, and two of them had died. And there was a head print on the back window that had hair and blood on it. And I dragged all three of my kids over there, and to this day, they're all north of 35. To this day, they remember the impact that that had on it, because that little girl in the back didn't have her seatbelt on, and she went out the back window. And so you just impress upon him that he has to wear it. And even to the point, you can test it yourself. You can devise a way to make sure that you know that the retractor's been pulled out. and there's ways that you can do that.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah, so anyway.
Yep. I actually left some blood and hair on a piece of glass myself at one point. So I'm definitely a proponent of the safety gear.
Yeah.
My second question is a little less serious. 2014 Toyota Tundra. My power windows squeak, and it sounds like the squeak may be coming from the actual track on the door rather than anything down inside the door of the actuators. I think when they get hot, they just kind of squeak against the window frame. Is anything that you can put on them that would help that?
Yeah, I would think that you'd get a spray can of silicone or Teflon. And if you're going to get Teflon, you got to shake the heck out of it, because otherwise you're not going to mix it up. And if the can says shake violently, I agree. And I would take a small rag, preferably not one of your wife's dish towels, and I would bring the window almost all the way to the top, and I'd start on the left-hand bottom, and I would rub about an inch all the way around that window the best I could. I'd also lightly spray if there's a track in the front. That's a U-shaped track. I would spray that, but more than likely,
I got 1 minute.
I got that. Yeah.
Okay. I would do that. If it changes things, then you're right. It's somewhere in that area. If it doesn't change things, then it's entirely possible that noise is radiated from the motor or the regulator, and you're just hearing it and thinking it's coming from up there. So I think go ahead.
I'm thinking it's coming from up there because it does it more prevalent when it's hot, like especially on the side of the vehicle that's in the sun. So I think it's probably in the track itself, and it's just the window fits fairly tight.
And it could very well be that plan B is pull the door panel off and with some white lithium grease spray the regulator, and especially where the regulator pivots on itself. So that's plan B if you can't get it that way. But thank you very much, Steve. All righty. You know what, Bob? I'm not going to be able to get you because I got to take a break in 6 seconds, but you're going to be my first caller on the other side. 602-508-0960. We have 4 lines available. We will be right back. Well, welcome back, everybody. I'm glad you're joining us. We're here for 2 hours, and so we're going to continue on till noon. But first, like I promised, we're going to go straight to Bob because he waited through the break last break. And, Bob, how can I help you today?
Morning, Mark. You know, if you're buying a new car at a dealer, you think it's better not, if you're going to pay cash, not to tell them till you've negotiated the price and everything, because they'll give you a better deal if they think you're going to finance it?
No, it's true that they make money on the financing. The cash doesn't mean anything to them. They don't care. They'd rather you finance it. But let me give you something that I have been working on for 6 months about new cars. I am of the opinion that if you can buy the car for the sticker price, which includes tax, license, weatherproofing, window tinting, mop and glow, desert protection package, all that stuff, if you can buy it for the sticker or less, you have hit a grand slam. I personally have been involved in at least 4 or 5 of those transactions and been successful. But in each and every time, the difference was $5,000 on top of the sticker. So if you can be sturdy, and if you can tell them, I had to say, I don't care about the window tint. I'm not paying you $300 for a window tint when I can get it done any day of the week for $75, $80. I don't care about your desert protection package. I don't care about your dock fee of $250. The girl's going to put my information in the computer, print out the contract, and we're done. So I don't know why that's $250. But I am just interested in negotiating from that point of view. And I can tell you, my daughter bought a brand new Dodge Caravan as a shuttle vehicle, and she got it for $200 or $300 less than sticker, and she wrote a check for that, and they didn't care whether we financed it or she wrote a check. So to answer your question, I don't think cash is going to be a benefit. If you're gonna play hide the truth, then tell them you want to finance it and you've got bad credit, and then because the credit rate will go up a lot higher and they make more money, and then at the last minute pull out and pay cash, and that might help you out.
Well, when you say sticker, you mean the MSRP, not the dealer sticker that has all that other stuff marked up on it already.
No, the MSRP is in the window. It's the sticker in the window. Whatever that total figure is. Now, it's already got freight in it, and you'll see freight is an add-on. So that sticker, if that sticker says $28,500, I want to buy it for $28,500. I want you to back it up and put all those stupid charges in there, including sales tax and license plates, which are the two big dogs, and I want you to back it up, and I want to buy it from there. All righty.
My son bought a 2014 GMC, and the MSRP was $42,000, mm-hmm. and he wrote him a check for $39,985 for everything out the door.
I'll bet it was at least a year old, though, right?
It was was a 2000. Yeah, I think the 15s were out already, yes. And it was a 2014.
There's nothing wrong with that. I still am impressed with that kind of value. I still am impressed.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you very much. Dan, you're up next. How can I help you?
Hello there. I'm going to be taking a trip up to Idaho. Going to see the eclipse in August. And I've got a twofold situation. You had mentioned what mean temperature the tires should run and what the area around the bearing should run. I've got my laser thermometer, and I just wanted to get that update again, please.
Okay, no problem. Okay, no problem. What I'm looking for is, I don't know what the word is. I want them to be all the same. I think it depends on the road. It depends on the load. I can tell you right now, north of 200 degrees, you got a problem. And the glue, I'm told the glue, yeah, 200 Fahrenheit. I'm talking about tires right now. The Fahrenheit at 200, you're in trouble. At 280, the glue comes apart and the tire comes apart. So I want to tell you that I've been doing laser testing of my tires on horse trailers and motorhomes and personal cars for the last 10 years, and I have never even come close to 200, even though one time I'm coming down the mountain, I'm driving a semi-truck with a trailer with 8 tires with a giant tractor on the back, and the inside dual on one of the rear axles is running hot. It's 30, 40, 50 degrees hotter than the other ones. I checked the air pressure, and it's way too low. So I got two choices. Slow down to 45 miles an hour and make it into town and deal with it then. Or I don't even have a spare, so I can't change it. And if I could change it, I don't have a jack that would lift it up. So I put my flashers on and drove all the way home with 45 miles an hour. So you're looking for the same. Now, so in your particular case, depending on the load, I would say that you're going to be between 90 on the low side and 140, 150 on the high side. As far as the wheel bearings are concerned, again, we're just looking for the same. So if you're going to shoot the right, you say you got a horse trailer with two axles and 4 tires. If you're going to shoot the hubs, then shoot the hubs in the same place on all 4 portions of your trailer, and there should all be the same. Anything that's dramatically different, you got a problem. That's all. And yes. I just...
And one quick question. I recently repacked bearings on an old trailer that had been sitting up at our property for quite some time. I've never had any trouble with bearings in the past. I repacked all these, adjusted them the way I've always done it, without a hitch, but the one bearing on the right rear, when I finished hauling a little tractor we had, you could barely touch the hub. It was so darn hot. I've adjusted and gone back and forth with it, and it hasn't shown much difference, so I've kept it slow, and I'm going to probably replace all the bearings and races here on pretty soon. But what would cause it to do that if there's no... there's no sign of head check wear on the bearing in the race. Everything looked good.
Okay, is it one axle or two?
It's a 2-axle.
And so which, do you got brakes on both or just the back?
No, brakes on the rear, and I've checked the brakes were not dragging. I've already double-checked and triple-checked on that.
Okay.
And
all right, well, let me ask you some questions real quick. In between the two races on the hub, did you add some grease in between those two? It's in the deep portion of the hub between the inner race and the outer race. There is a indentation in the hub. Did you go ahead and put some grease all the way around in there?
Okay. It's one of those hubs that you can go ahead and add grease with the cert.
Okay.
I greased the bearings, and then on top of that, I filled it up until it just barely started to pooch the grease out on the outside.
Okay. Then the answer to your question is you're going to have to take it apart. If you're adamant that the brakes aren't dragging and the drum isn't blue, then when you take it apart, if it's really running hot, you're going to find one of the races, one of the bearings is going to show heat. Now, the real question is what happens when you get to the point where the drum doesn't have any hot spots in it, the brakes aren't dragging, and you get in there and find that those bearings and races are pristine?
Yeah, that's the question.
Okay.
That's what's
all right. Well, the only thing that can – I mean, there's only 3 things that are going to cause heat: the bearing, the races, the brakes, or the tire, and the wheel. That's it. That's all it can be. Make sure the tire is fastened to the hub good, but it can only be that. So you can't say to me, and I'm not suggesting that you are, but you can't say the tire's not running hot, the bearing races look brand new, the bearings look brand new, and the brakes aren't dragging, and I've got something that's quite a bit different, 30, 40, 50 degrees hotter than the other 3. Now, something, we're missing something. That's all. And I'm going to tell you something. Every day of my life, I miss something. So I understand.
Indeed. Like I say, I've repacked bearings all my life and had no trouble until now. So I thought maybe you could shed some light on it, but you've covered everything I have. So I'll take it apart again and take another look. So
okay.
I appreciate your effort.
And when you do the nut, if you're going to do the nut, what I do is I tighten up the nut finger tight and I'm squeezing the grease out of the bearing. So I have a metal to metal contact. Then I back it up, and then I bring it back in. I touch the bearings again. I might go a quarter more turn, and then I pin it. So that's how I do it. Anyway, thank you very much, Dan. I appreciate that very much. Automatic Transmission Exchange is on 40th Street in Washington. He's been around since 1968. Phil does a great job. He rebuilds transmissions. He repairs transmissions. And he's smart enough, and his staff is smart enough to know that because there's Paul, Phil, and Trey, those guys can drive a car, and almost every time they know where the problem's at. Now, they're not going to be able to bid the problem until they verify that it's there where they think it is, but they're very good at what they do, and they've been around, again, I think it's the longest transmission shop I know of in the Valley, 1967. So if you've ever gone, actually it's 1968. Phil, if you've ever gone down Washington at 40th Street in Washington on the north side of the road, you've seen the same building, and he's been there for a very long time. All righty, I want to tell you a real quick story. Real quick. My daughter runs our company. She's been around our shop for 20 years, and what she has that few other people have ever done is she reads every single work order that goes through our shop. Now, the work order has what the customer said, all the customer's symptoms, what the customer said specifically, dash, 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 then what was our diagnostic process and what was the outcome, and then was the repair successful, okay? So we have that on the work order. So she gets to read all that. So the other day she's at the front counter. Her name is Andy, A-N-D-I. And she's at the front counter, and this very nice gentleman comes in. He's a brand new customer. He's never been in before. And he tells her, I want you to do this, this, and this, and this, and I want you to replace the front brakes. And she says, okay, why are we replacing the front brakes? Because that's a rule of mine. Why? I want to make sure I'm going to fix your symptom, because I don't want to fix your front brakes or put new front brakes on and then have you say, well, you didn't fix it. And I'm going to say, fix what? You didn't tell me to fix anything. You just told me to replace your front brake. So Andy says, why are we fixing your front brakes? And he goes, because I want you to. And she says, we are not just going to replace your front brakes unless they need it. So while we have it on the rack, we'll go ahead and check the front brakes. So it turns into a very light-spirited argument. Andy says, did you just come from another place that told you you needed brakes? And I think he said yes. And she says, okay, what did they tell you? And he says, well, they told me I had 7:30 seconds left and that I needed brakes. And she said, no, you need brakes at 2:30 seconds or maybe 3:30 seconds, but not 7:30 seconds, because 7:30 seconds is a very acceptable amount of pad left. We wouldn't be taking those pads off, because at this particular point, the pads are likely to be more than 50% still there, 40% gone. So anyway, the car gets into the rack and they're all fine. But during this process, this gentleman, nice guy, he doesn't like, by his actions, he didn't really want to talk to a lady. So my son walks by. And Alan's a big kid. He's like 6'4". And the guy stops him and starts talking to him about brakes. Well, Andy's sitting at one of the service rider desks. So she's kind of, you know, doing what she does. But she's also got one ear bent over towards the conversation. And Alan tells him the same thing that Andy told him. 2:30 seconds, 3:30 seconds is replacement time. 7:30 seconds is not. He thanks him very much, slaps him on the shoulder, and sits down. I want to tell you, there's lots of ladies in the auto repair industry that are really smart, that they've been around a very long time, and you should be careful about making a woman mad in an auto repair store, because she might be the owner's boss or the owner's daughter, or she might be the owner. And you have to be careful. It shouldn't take you too long to ask questions.
2 minutes.
For them to develop the feeling that they know what they're talking about. So it is true that most brake pads come between 10 and 14, 30 seconds. But if you're at 14 and you still have 7, then you know where you're at. That's something the shop should have told him. But maybe he wasn't listening. You know how us guys are. Sometimes we listen to what we want to listen to and nothing more and nothing less. So anyway, Andy wasn't offended. She just told me what she thought was a funny story. Okay, a guy writes me and he tells me that he's got a car and he's put two drive shafts in it. He's taken it to drive shaft number one. He's got this vibration and they worked on it and it didn't change it and he can't buy a new one because they don't make it for this car anymore. Then he took it to the second drive shaft company and they did some work on it and that didn't fix it either. And I said to him, I think we should reanalyze who diagnosed the drive shaft vibration. And he goes, I did. And I said, I think we needed a clean pair of eyes on your car because we can put some hose clamps on your drive shaft and we can show you what a drive shaft vibration really sounds like. And we can actually make it better or worse by just putting some hose clamps wrapped around your drive shaft. So why don't we try that? And I said, I'll tell you what I'll do is I'll have my best vibration guy drive your car for free. And let's see if it's a vibration. And we can also put some transmitters underneath your car and find out where the vibration is at. So we have a lot of technology that we can identify the vibration, but my problem is you've already spent money with two shops and they've done drive shaft work two times and you tell me that it is neither better or worse. And so that leads me to believe that we aren't on the right page. We're not on the right track. So anyway, he hasn't showed up, but I still have the offer to him. Bring your car by and we'll drive it and we'll tell you what we think. And that's for free. Nevertheless, 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960.
Mark.
Welcome back, everybody, for the second hour of the Car Show right here on KKNT every Saturday from 10 o'clock till noon. And we've got a couple of callers, but I got a little business to take care of. Air Park Auto is up in North Scottsdale. And actually, if you go north of McCormick Parkway all the way to Carefree, and from the west at 56th Street all the way to Fountain Hills, I only have one shop up there on my best car repair shops list. Folks, I'm sure there's good other shops up there, but we have a pretty strict requirement list. And some of them haven't been in business for 5 years, and some of them perhaps have some bad reviews or a lot of bad reviews, or perhaps maybe the owner is an absentee owner. Those are the things that we just would prefer not to deal with. But I don't have to deal with any of that with Nadine, who owns Air Park Auto Service, the only lady-owned and operated auto repair shop in the valley that I know of. And Nadine's a smart lady. She's been around for a very long time. Her and Stacy, her husband, opened up the Air Parks in the Air Park in 1985. They're on Raintree just east of Hayden, and they're still family-owned and operated. Stacy passed away a few years ago, and Nadine kind of explored a little bit about selling the business, but then she decided, no, I'm going to stay and run it. So she's a very strong woman. She knows cars, and she surrounds herself with people that she can trust. So if you live in North Scottsdale, and I'm sorry to tell you, even from the Fountain Hills area, if you like those shops that I endorse, then you're going to have to go over to the 101 and Frank Lloyd Wright, just south and west, to visit Nadine at Air Park Auto. Hilton, good morning to you. How can I help you, Hilton?
Hey, Mark, love your show. Hey, question is a transmission. We were driving to Idaho this year. And doing about 80 plus, and all of a sudden I noticed my RPM revs up, and I look back, there's smoke coming out the back, so I pull over right away, and transmission fluid all over the front of the car and out the bottom and out the back. So they towed it to a transmission shop. They went through the car, cleaned it up, and said, hey, we cleaned it up, put in 2 quarts of transmission fluid, and we found no leaks. It looks like it came out the vent valve or something like that.
A vent on top of the transmission case.
Yeah, and so it vented out of that, they believe. And so they filled me up, and we made it back to the valley. What do you think happened, or is that a problem I need to be concerned with, or just an anomaly?
Well, I need to ask you a few questions. Were you in the mountains?
Sure.
Were you hauling a trailer? Were you flogging it pretty hard?
It was, pretty hard, and full of 5 people and grandma and the dog and all the luggage. It's a 2000 minivan, Honda Odyssey.
Okay. All right.
So it was working, but I've done that in the past.
Okay. I understand, but maybe the circumstances, the environment, and the load, and then perhaps you were doing up or down a grade. I don't know the circumstances, but what happens is when you overheat a transmission, one of the first things it'll do is expel fluid out of the vent. If it doesn't blow the cooler clean out of the radiator, or if it doesn't pop one of the cooler lines that goes from the transmission to the transmission cooler in front of the vehicle and then back. The mere fact that you got home and had no other problems is good news. It suggests at the time when you were admitting to doing, what'd you say, 80?
Yeah. Yeah.
So let me get this straight. You got your wife and grandma in the car, and no one's screaming at you when you're doing 80 plus. Are you trying to feed me that line of bull? did you have masking tape over the speedometer, or did you have the music loud, or did you have blindfolds on all those ladies?
I know. It was 75, the speed limit up there.
Oh, yeah. So now he changes his story. You heard him, folks. He said 80 plus. No, I'm teasing you, of course. I'm teasing you. Every guy in the world's laughing with me right now, and the women aren't. But really and truly, the only thing I would do if I were you is, now that you've circulated that fluid, I'd take it by a trusted transmission shop and have them smell the fluid, or you smell the fluid. And if it's burnt, then we need to flush the fluid out of it. So it's very likely you had your foot deep into the floor. It's very likely you were loaded up. It's very likely you were maybe going up a grade, maybe 2 or 3 or 4 or 7% grade. I don't know. And you just overheated it. The good news is you got home, and I don't think anything more than perhaps a flush is what you would do, and what I would tell you to do. So I think that we're on the same track. Okay.
And the car has about 100,000 miles on this transmission.
Okay.
So it's pretty new, I guess.
Yeah, and no, you're right. But perhaps maybe you should have pulled it out of overdrive. Perhaps you were kind of running it kind of hard in sixth gear. All right. So maybe you should have downshifted once or twice and just brought the RPMs up and taken a little bit of load off that transmission, because it's going to work harder in sixth gear than it is in fourth gear. You might have to back off the speed a little bit, but those are the kinds of things. I know that on my big trucks, when I'm hauling, if I'm going up a grade, my transmission temperature comes up, and so does my exhaust gas temperature, and so does my cooling system. But if I downshift from 6th to 4th or 6th to 5th, I can cool everything down visually. I mean, I can see a difference. So then I have to decide whether I want to slow down or not. But anyway, thank you, Hilton. Thank you very much. Good luck to you. David, you're up next. How can I help you?
I have a 2001 Mazda Tribute, and the shifter cable from the column to the transmission, the bushings broke on each side. And I am not technical or mechanical enough to replace the whole cable, and I can only find online a cable with the bushings on it, and I'm just looking for the bushings on each side that I can replace. And I can't find to get the bushing.
How much is the cable?
$179.
Okay. All right. Are the bushings rubber in nature or white nylon in nature? What are they?
I have no idea, because when the shifter column just started, it just went up and down, and I couldn't get it into park. Now I kind of have it jimmy-rigged to where on the shifter column, I have zip ties, attaching it.
Right.
But I'm just looking for the bushings itself, and I can't find anywhere that I can actually just find the bushings to put on there, be it rubber or nylon.
Okay. Well, here's what I was going to say. Once you get the cable in your hand and you know where the bushings belong, and you know what they're, are they round, are they square, are they long, are they short, what's the internal diameter, what's the outside diameter. Once you get all that, you can probably take it to a gray-haired guy at an auto parts store, not the three-whiskered kid, but the gray-haired guy, and he can probably match up your bushings. But you're not even close to being there. So unless you're willing to take that cable out, unless you're willing to, and you keep calling them bushings, but really you don't know that they're bushings. all you know is the cable's moving on one end or the other. So instead of the housing being held in one place and the cable moving in and out of the housing, for whatever reason, the housing's moving, so you're assuming it's a bushing, so you've wrapped the cable housing to the steering column or to some other non-moving part, and that's made it better. So I don't agree that looking for bushings, I agree that looking for bushings is a waste of your time. I think you should either get the part number and Google the heck out of it and see if you can find it cheaper, or maybe find one at a wrecking yard. But I think the only other option is you take that cable out of there, and once you can determine what the problem is, then you can probably go have somebody make something or sell you something that'll fix it. It's entirely possible both ends of the cable housing, the outside part, have to be secured so that the cable within can move left and right, up and down, and not carry the housing with it. So if the housing is moving...
That's correct.
Okay, if the housing is moving, then you've lost a clamp somewhere. So the question is where? So I don't know about this bushing thing, because that's why I ask you the colors and stuff, is because I'm not familiar with what you're talking about. But I think if you've made it better by securing the housing, I think one end or both of the housing has come loose from its respective brackets, and this jerry rig that you did is working for you, then I would take it into a shop and say, can you secure one or both of these ends a little better with a hose clamp or something? And they're probably going to be able to do that for you. But I, without seeing it, and you're asking me a question I've never been asked for before, but I can visualize in every other car in the world, the housing, the outer housing, doesn't move and the cable slides within. So we pull and push on one end, we activate on the other. All righty. Good luck to you, David. Good luck. 602-508-0960, 602-508-0960. One of the guys on my shops that I refer to on a regular basis is Kurt's Auto Repair. He's up at I-17 in Bell, the kind of the northeast portion of that intersection. He's been around a long time, since 1987. He was one of the last year's Better Business Bureau Ethics Award winners, and that really does kind of say a lot. Now, Kurt's a good guy. His wife is a perfect lady. And if you're a first-time customer, sometime after your visit, she's going to knock on your door with homemade bakery goods and saying thank you to you. And that's something that we used to do in the 50s and 60s and the 70s, but nobody does that anymore. But everybody gets something from Kurt and his wife after your first visit, and as an opportunity to say, how did we do? So if you're looking for a good repair shop and you're close to I-17 and Bell, Kurt's is a good place. Now, Jeff is a service manager. He's an ASE master. Then we've got Eric, who's the shop foreman and the big dog in the shop, and he's an ASE master. So you've got two heads there that probably are not going to struggle much as the two of them work on some sophisticated problems. Kurt's Auto Repair, I-17, and Bell Road. Let's see where we're at. A customer writes me the other day and says to me, Mark, my front shocks on my car that has 210,000 miles, I just did them. Should I do the rears? Now, folks, let's look at 210,000 miles. 210,000 miles is 8 times around the equator. Because the equator is somewhere around 24,800 and some odd miles. And let's, if you'll allow me to round it off to 25,000 miles, then...
Please do.
He's, you know what? Gil just said, please do round it off. Gil, you know that I'm going to say 25, and I'm going to get 8
there
emails.
There you go, 1 minute.
They're going to say, you're wrong. It's 28,482 and a half miles. But just let me round it off, because I'm terrible in math. It's 8 times around the girth of the earth. So my answer is, buddy, if you did the fronts, then you need to do the rears, and you're a little late. But here's what I'm going to tell you. Let's forget about the 210,000 miles. Let's talk about the 50 to 100. Most people that do major shock work between 50 and 100 that do business with me, I call them and say to them, is there a difference? And they say yes. And I said, was it worth the difference? And almost unilaterally, they say no. What they're saying is the cost wasn't worth the improvement. So, folks, it is true that a shock absorber is a slight safety issue, but I want to tell you, in all the years I've been an expert in the automotive repair field and tires and mechanical issues, I've never seen an accident blamed on a shock absorber until just recently. And the case settled, and the shock absorber was initially raised. I did my examination of the shock absorber as well as when it was made and when it was put on the truck. And in reality, I think everybody agreed the shock absorber had nothing to do with it, except one attorney thought it was the shock absorber. So As far as shock absorbers are concerned, you're on your own, but that's the benefit of my experience. 602-508-0960. Nobody's on the line. There's five of them. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back, everybody. 21 minutes after the hour of 11 o'clock. My name's Mark Salem, and let me tell you about a superstar when it comes to tires. S&S Tires really handles the West Valley. They do Peoria, Surprise, Goodyear, and everything in between. So they have three locations. They've been around since 1976. The father passed away in the last year, and the two sons are running it. And to be perfectly honest with you, in every way, shape, or form, it's a great family. A great family. They have a comprehensive lines of tires and many different brands of tires. So when you go in, you can say, give me a total price I can write my check for good, better, best. And they can do that, and they've got those tires in inventory. So no matter what you've got on your car, from wheelbarrow tires to the largest, you know, farm tractors and everything in between, S&S has got you covered. They'll balance your tires. They do alignments. They do suspension work. So if you're in the West Valley, then perhaps you can visit an S&S tire location and get the information you need so that you can make a good, intelligent decision. Let's go to the phones. Larry, you're first. How can I help you?
Hi, Mark. I have a question about a battery for you. So I've got a later model car that doesn't have a voltmeter. It just has a battery light.
Okay.
Monday morning, started my car, went to the grocery store, it started fine. When I came out of the grocery store, it turned over about three times and then just clicked. And so I got a jump start, got home, put the battery in a charger, and then took it out and took it into Napa. They tested it, and it said that it had a dead cell. It was under warranty with Napa, so they replaced it for free. But my question is, with a newer car, what is the proper way, how should we be testing the battery to ensure that the battery is in good condition?
Okay.
The gauges and lights in the car don't tell us the condition of the battery.
Okay. All right. No, they don't. So for you to come to a conclusion on whether you need a battery or don't need a battery or whatever is useless from the inside of the car. First of all, you violated one of Mark Salem's Ten Commandments, and that is you test everything where it lives. Number two, if this was a sealed battery, to tell you that one of the cells was bad is beyond my capability. So without popping the lid off the battery and using a hydrometer to measure the specific gravity of every cell, I am incapable, and I know no one else who's capable of identifying a bad cell. Now, the slow cranking click, click, click means that the voltage in the battery or the voltage provided to the starter is substandard and fell below 9.6. So that tells me that. The real question is were the cables dirty? Was there any resistance value there? Now, you can say no, but perfectly good cables, when I do a volt drop test, I go across the two terminals and I've got 12.8. Then I move my negative to the engine ground and I have 11.8. And even though the cable looks pretty, then I've lost a volt. And likewise, that's called a volt drop test. And you're going to move both the negative and the positive side of your digital voltometer. So you didn't test it where it lived, which you should have done. If it's anywhere near 3 years, it was due anyway. If you want to test your own car and use a voltmeter, I'll tell you this. The alternator should put out 1 volt over the key in your pocket voltage. Keys in your pocket, you take the voltage reading, a fully charged battery is 13 volts. So if you pop it and it's a 12.8 and you start it up and it goes to 13.8, bingo, we're done. If it's at 13, then it better go to 14 or thereabouts. So, and at no time should the battery voltage ever drop below 9.6. And when it does, you'll lose all your presets on your radio, your presets on your seat, and your presets on your climate control. So that will tell you that it dropped below 9.6. I know that's a lot to digest, but if your battery, I'm going to assume your battery was 3 years thereabouts, and really and truly that's about the time that most of them are lasting, between 2 and 3 years in Arizona with the heat and the vibration and the hot air with no moisture. That just causes a toll on your battery. But thank you very much for that, Larry. Let me see where I'm at here, because I can get Kevin. Kevin, how are you, buddy? How can I help you?
Good morning, Mark. Nice to talk to you. I've got the pedometer cable pop problem. I took our 1995 D350 van to wash it today. The speedometer was working. I noticed after I washed it, it wasn't working. And the on the shifter, the overdrive light was blinking also. The overdrive, it works, button works. As I was driving, it was fine. Just no speedometer reading on mechanical cable. And I don't quite know what to do with that.
Well, the process is to go down to the transmission and disconnect the cable from the transmission, and there's a drive gear, which is inside the transmission, and then there's a driven gear on the end of the cable. So the first thing you have to do is get the tail end of the van up in the air and put it in drive and spin the back wheels, and you can look inside the transmission and see that the drive gear is working. Usually we take the cable, the internal portion of the cable out, and we stick it in the drive gear, and we hold it with a gloved hand while the speedometer is going 5 miles an hour. We want to make sure that the teeth are intact and the drive gear inside the tail shaft of the transmission is not slipping. So sometimes the teeth will be chewed off because the cable gets so nasty inside. So that's why we do that. Now, if you've got the drive gear good, then you put the cable back in and you go up to and you make sure the driven gear is good, and you take your fingers and you spin the cable within the housing. And it should move very, very freely. And if it doesn't, then you got to fix that. Most of the time you pull the guts out of the cable and you find this big old grease spot that's twice as big as the cable itself. You take your pocket knife, scrape it all off, get some carb clean, do that. You just run the cable through a bunch of white moly grease, stick it back in there, boom, you're done. Then, if you still don't have a speedometer, you got to go up to the speedometer and you got to pull, disconnect the cable on the back and verify that when the rear wheels spin, that the cable's moving. If the cable's moving, then the speedometer head went to speedometer head heaven. Now you got to go to a Speedo shop like Dick Speedo and Tack at 7th Street and Indian School just north and have him deal with your speedometer head. The overdrive light flashing is just simply telling you that I'm having a tough time because I want to go into overdrive, but I don't see a speed that I recognize as being a valid speed. So don't worry about the overdrive. Let's get the Speedo fixed first, okay?
2 minutes.
Okay, real good. Hey, thanks a lot. Appreciate
you bet.
The program.
Thank you very much. David and Joe, I don't have time, but David, I'm going to take your question, and then I'm going to answer it after the break. So go right ahead, David. What kind of question have you got?
Yeah, hi, Mark. My question is just wanted to have a 2006 Ridgeline with 116,000 miles on it and needs a number of things done. I wanted to get your opinion on trying to fix it up with these items I need to get done or whether to look at buying a newer vehicle.
Okay. All right. Well, just off the cuff, and I'm going to keep you, and we're going to talk more about this. Off the cuff is, I can tell you this much. Everything's due at 100,000 miles, all your belts, your hoses, and your fluids. I don't know about your brakes because I don't know if you drive highway or city and all that stuff. But the cost associated with a new vehicle will buy you an engine or a transmission and sometimes both. Just the cost of the license plates and sales tax, which are a non-recoverable funds.
1 minute.
So when you're trying to decide to keep the old one because of the expense of the repair versus the new one, if I say to you, the old one I'm going to fix up for $1,200, and you're going to spend $6,000 on license plates and sales tax, that seems to be easy, providing the car is in pretty decent shape. So today we know that most everything's moving to a 80, 75 to 100,000 mile interval. So at 116, if you've not done any of the fluids, belts, and hoses, and then brakes, tires, and shocks are other things we're going to look at, then you're due. So when we come back, you probably have a list, and we'll go over them quickly, one by one, and we'll see what we can come up with. Joe, you'll be next, and that means we have three lines available, 602-508-0960. You can also always get a hold of me at mark@marksalem.com. mark@marksalem.com, and leave your phone number. I may call you from my blocked cell, so you'll have to answer it if you send me an email. Welcome back. Excuse me. Welcome back, everybody. It's 34 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock. We're going to go back to David real quick. And David, have you been provided a list of stuff that you need by a shop?
Yeah, and they've been corroborated by the Honda place and an independent guy. I just wanted to say one thing, too, when I talk about a newer vehicle, I only buy stuff from, like, a private owner to avoid sales tax. And then I'm only talking 2014, 2015 at the newest. So
okay.
I'm not looking at something off the lot or anything.
And I did notice that I take 116 and I divide it by 12 years, and you're driving a whopping 10,000 miles a year. So I'm looking at the big picture here, and I still haven't changed my mind because it's the Ridgeline is a good vehicle. The Ridgeline's going to let you down when you overheat it, a severe overheat. I don't know what you've got, but you've got the dealer and you've got the independent shop giving you a list of stuff. But then on top of that, you got your service manual, and you may, I'd be willing to bet you $10 that you're going to find some of both of their lists not apparent or not in or not listed in your owner's manual. Those are things that you need to do. As far as shocks and struts are concerned, if you're not having any tire wear and you're happy with the ride, I'd skip that. Like I said before, fluids, belts, and hoses are the three big dogs that you're going to have. So if you want to upgrade, I'd be the last guy to tell you not to upgrade because you're spending your money, not mine. But I don't know that you're going to get a better deal than the deal you got right now at 10 years, at 10 years or 12 years, or not 12, it's 6 and 7, 11 years old car with 116,000 miles. If you were to spend, let's say, worst case scenario, they want to do struts and shocks, you spend $2,000 bringing this up, that $2,000 is going to carry you for another 10 years. So until you hit the next 100,000 miles.
Yeah, let me just go over the list quickly because I definitely agree with you on the struts and stuff. But you know, and then you know the cost.
Just give me the name, and I'm going to say yes or no.
Yeah. So at 120, I'm going to need the timing belt.
Yes.
Had it done at 60. Now it's going to be 120. And then at 120 plus a little bit of whatever, the valves are going to need to be adjusted.
No.
Then the rear main seal is wet.
No.
One mechanic.
No. Wet. Wet is a wussy word. Wet is a seep, and it's weeping, and it's wet.
Right.
That's just though. Can you tell my panties are wadded up right now? I hate those words. I tell my staff I will twist your lips in a knot if I hear you use weeping, seeping, and wet. Those words. Now, it may very well appear on your service manual or a service ticket that says, "We see some wetness of the rear main seal. Keep an eye on your driveway. If you see something that's bigger than a dollar bill, get back with us." That's a valid thing.
Okay.
But I'm not going to go along with the weeping and seeping rear main seal. I'm not going to go along with the valve adjustment for this reason: loose ones clatter, and tight ones cause a backfire. So if you don't have either one of those symptoms, what are we fixing? So go on with your list real quick.
Well, yeah, one more thing, too, is these aren't things that they have to be done right now, but I'm talking in the next year. So if I keep the car, there are things that would likely need to be done. So it's not stuff they're telling me I have to do at this moment.
All right. Well, the car's been around the world four times, and you haven't needed a valve adjustment yet. So now we've got a guy that's telling you that he's going to be able to tell you in another year whether you need a valve adjustment. That just doesn't fly in the face of common sense. You're the best judge of that. If the thing runs rough and the valves are too tight, that's one thing. If it's clattering first thing in the morning and it stays there throughout the day, that's another. The problem is that if you want to do it my way, you do it by symptom-driven stuff. If you want to do it because you want the car to love you, then spend all the money you want. But you had a couple things on your list. Let me comment about those real quick.
Yeah, the last major thing was... I guess it needs new motor mounts. Some of them are only cracked, but I guess the main ones that take the torque when you start up are looking kind of bad.
Okay, so we have a cracked motor mount. That's another thing that just drives me crazy. Now, we have a load motor mount. That's every time you get the gas, the motor leans to that load mount. When the load motor mount collapses, then you have a vibration in drive that goes away when you put it in neutral. You don't have that. So it's a great idea for me to sell you four motor mounts and tell you that, oh, boy, they're cracked. Because, see, most people that are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, they're scared by wetness and cracked. But if I were the king of the auto repair industry, I would strike those words from their vocabulary because that's a fail-safe way to keep the attorney generals off your back by trying to sell something. Well, I used an adjective, wetness or cracked or weeping or seeping. That's what they're saying. They're not going to sit down and say, you need a rear main seal. The other day, a lady says, the guy called me and said I needed a rear main seal. And I said, okay, well, how do I know that? And he goes, well, it has to have been leaking on your driveway. And she says, oh, I look at my driveway every day of my life. There's not a single drop in my driveway. And she says, you'd have thought that he was 10 years old and he just got caught with his hand in the cookie jar. And so the fact of the matter is if you had a rear main seal and you keep an eye on your driveway, you'd know it long before they knew it. However, I've had my piece. Good luck to you. And Joe, I'm sorry I didn't get to you, but you'll be my first caller on the other end of the break. And Bob, you're right behind him. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back, everybody. My name's Mark Salem, and we've got two callers on the line. I need to tell you real quick about Action Auto Repair at I-17 in Deer Valley. I've known Tom since the late 80s, and he's a good guy. He actually has ASE Master Certified Technicians. He does repair, maintenance. He does light trucks. He does cars. He does all kinds of vehicles, and he's really good about telling you what you're up against and giving you related pricing and giving you the window of when you can do it and when you don't need to do it or when you have to do it. So when it gets down to it, if you're near I-17 and Deer Valley Road, then Action Auto Repair is a good place. So if you don't have one, maybe stop by, get an oil change, and then from there decide if they might be a shop for you. Real quick before I take Joe, David, thank you for the callback. David, I wasn't mad at you, and I think you recognize that. I'm mad at our industry. And here's why, David. David, the technician tells the service writer, well, and actually it can even get worse than that. The technician tells the shop foreman tells the service writer, or the dispatcher tells the service writer, and the service writer regurgitates this to the customer. The technician is supposed to be specific. He's supposed to not use words like wet without an explanation. He's not supposed to use the word like cracked motor mounts without an explanation. And even if he did get an explanation, chances of it getting the service writer are slim and none. However, here's the real issue. Is the service writer protecting you from the technician? Or is the service writer benefiting the technician by flushing your wallet? That's the real issue. Who does the service writer work for? There's plenty of shops in town where the service writer is specifically told to represent the customer, do what's in the customer's best interest. I just don't understand why we can't use an explanation when we use the word cracked and wet and seeping and weeping. Just tell them, hey, David, if you got an oil leak that's bigger than a silver dollar or a half a dollar bill, then come back and see us. I think it's going to be the rear main seal, and I'll give you an estimate then. Why can't we do that? Why can't we say your motor mounts are old? But here's what you need to look for. A vibration in drive at a stop that goes away when you put it in neutral or reverse. And anytime you want, come on by and I'll check it for you for free. Because it just takes me 5 seconds in the parking lot and I can tell you if the motor mounts are bad. So that's the kind of conversation we should have. We don't, and we leave it open for interpretation. And, of course, there's always the scare factor in there. That's what I object to. Not to you, but to them. Joe, good morning to you. How can I help you?
Good morning, Mr. Salem. I've got a question regarding RV trailer tires.
Okay.
I've got a 98 travel trailer. It came with 205, 75, 15 load range Cs. There's been a lot of, if you read any of the blogs, the RV blogs, trailer tires are notorious for blowing up and giving a lot of problems and so forth. So I upgraded to 225, 75, 15, so two sizes more, and I went to load range E now. I went to D. The original ones were Cs. I went to Ds now. I'm up to Es and so forth. I was at the RV show in Quartzsite, Arizona years ago, and I expressed concern to the Goodyear booth that about the tires and the longevity of them, you know, how long they last and everything. And the guy told me if you'd never want to have any problems with your RV tires, they're change them out every 3 years and you won't have a problem. And I've done that and I've never had a problem. So that system does work.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't.
Well, my tires all look real good when I get rid of them. And
you know, every tire that blows up looks good. You know what? Every tire that blows up looks good the day before.
Yeah.
That's real self-serving of him. He's playing the odds. Oh, replace your tires every 3 years and you'll never have a problem. That's just not true. And I want to ask you something. Did you take out an ST tire and put on a P passenger or an LT light truck?
No, always went with STs.
Oh, STs, huh? Did you know that they have a 65-mile-an-hour speed limit on them and they blow at 68?
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay. And what inflation do you run them at?
I run them just a hair under maximum.
Okay. All right. That has more to do with it than anything else in the world. I disagree with the Goodyear guy, and I find fault with what he told you. The fact that you're running them at maximum inflation or a tad under, the fact that you've got a P-metric or an LT tire and a load range higher than you're carrying, and the fact that you probably have 12,000 pounds of tire underneath a trailer that weighs 8,000 pounds, that's bingo, bingo, bingo. That's why you aren't having any tires. All the rest of those people on the RV, they wouldn't know an ST or a P passenger or an LT tire if it jumped up and bit them in the earlobe. All of them are running 75, 80 miles an hour pulling their trailers. And if you need evidence of that, drive between Fountain Hills and Swore Lake. The road is littered with trailer tires.
Oh, yeah.
So
I've seen the carcasses.
What you're doing is perfect, and that's the reason you're the exception. I'm an exception along with you because I go to LT tires, light truck tires, and I've got, you know, some of my trailers, I got 30,000 pounds of tires underneath a trailer that's going to weigh 20,000 pounds. And so I'm always good. So the 3 years is not a valid number. Your RV tires will last somewhere between 5 and 7, depending on the load range, depending on how fast, and depending on how well they've been kept up and what the tire wear is. But to replace them at every 3,000 miles is self-serving, and I would hope none of my staff would ever say something like that. So good luck to you, Joe, but you bring up a good point, and thank you for bringing up that discussion. And I'm especially proud of you because all three questions, you had the right answer. You knew 65, you knew you had an ST, and you upgraded it from a C to D to an E. And that's just a home run. You did your job, and you did it magnificently. Bob, you're up next. How can I help you?
Yes, I have a 2005 Acura TL. It's got 70,000 miles on it. It's been serviced at the dealership since day one. It's never, they tell me that it's 15 years old, or 12 years old, so they tell me that it needs a new timing belt. Is that true?
I wouldn't let you take my grandkids to a Dairy Queen 3 miles away. I'm teasing you now, of course. You're way past my comfort zone. Way past. Now, the 70,000 miles isn't, but the fact that your car's, 11, 12 years old is. I want you to know, based on my studies, that a car that's normally used every day, 8 years and 80,000 miles is where I think you should start thinking about getting rid of your rubber stuff. Now, on your Acura, I'm pretty sure it's going to call for a timing belt at 100 to 120,000. So on the 70 versus the 100 to 120,000, you're fine. But you're not fine by doubling the mileage or doubling the time. So the timing belt goes through heat cycles. Every time you run it, it gets hot. Every time you park it, it gets cold. Heat cycles is what causes rubber to deteriorate, just like your tires. When you drive them, they get hot. And when you park them, they get cold. So I think you're running on borrowed time. I would agree, and listen to me carefully, I agree with your dealer that a timing belt should have been done at the beginning of this summer. If you want to gamble and try to run the end of the summer till October, go ahead. But without a doubt, I would put a timing belt on that next April before next summer. That's my advice to you. And by the way, are they going to do the water pump and the timing belt tensioner and the guides while they go in there and do the timing belt, or did they say anything about that?
No, they did talk about that. Okay. And then they also talked about a major tune-up as required for adjusting the valves and what have you.
Okay. Well, you already know how I feel about the valves. If they're too loose, they're clattering. If they're too tight, then it's got a rough idle and sometimes a backfire. I want to tell you, I don't adjust valves on anything I own, and I tell my customers the same thing. So I'm not a real fan, and as far as spark plugs are concerned, unlike your timing belt, the spark plugs aren't going to wear out in 70,000 miles. So I would disagree that 70,000 indicates that you need a set of plugs or a tune-up, and you are the best one to decide. Here's why. Your car passes emissions every year or every other year, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Your fuel economy hasn't dramatically changed that is unexplainable. Otherwise, if you put four of your big buddies in the back and you put all your golf clubs and you head to Tucson, you know you're not going to get the fuel economy you normally get. So your fuel economy hasn't changed. You pass emissions all the time. The car idles and accelerates smoothly. So I ask you, with my tongue in my cheek, What do you think you're going to get better by having a tune-up on the 70,000-mile motor?
Got it. Okay. Now, is it this work? Now, a regular shop could do this work as well as a dealership?
You bring up a good point, and I was going to leave that alone, but you already opened that door for me. There is the only comfort that can be associated, and I hear this every day of my life, that the dealer's done all the work, is that the dealer's likely to be there in 10 years, 20 years, same dealer, or at least some of the staff is the same. The independent repair shops and chain stores don't have that kind of longevity. So in that respect, the dealer is one up on us. But I want to tell you something. The difference between the dealer tech and my techs is this. The dealer tech works on rabbits all day long, and he wouldn't know how to fix an elephant, a giraffe, a snake, or a dog. But the independent repair guys knows from Acuras to Mercury Zephyrs and everything in between, and they have, in my opinion, a far better understanding of internal combustion engines and what makes them tick, and they can apply it to any engine, which is our responsibility. So in that respect, and so we're more of a veterinarian. Where a veterinarian handles all kinds of animals, and that's what the independent shop is. I also want to tell you that 50% of the dealer techs that I hire don't last very long for one of two reasons. One reason is they can't, you give them a Ford Taurus and tell them to pull the heads on it, and they just want to wet their pants. And all they want is Chryslers, and all they want is air conditioning on Chryslers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other part, they leave because they can't handle the volume. And the other half of it is they leave because we clearly can see that. And in spite of the fact that they don't see it, we do. And so in a kind way, the conversation sounds like this. How long do you think it'll take you to find another job? And they may say, I can have another job in a week. And I say, okay, I'm going to give you a week's worth of severance pay. I'm going to tell you today, let's go look for another job because I don't think you're going to be happy here, and I don't think you're going to make the money here that you want to make. And part of the reason is I can't give you all the Chrysler AC jobs I've got because they aren't, I'm not getting eight of them a day. So that's kind of what happens. But, there, you know, for recalls and all the other kind of stuff, you have to go to the dealer, and that's okay. But you open that door, and I'm going to step through it. So anyway.
Well, I appreciate that.
All right. Thank you very much, Bob. Thank you. Thompson's Auto
Repair. Brian is your next caller.
Okay, hang on, Brian. Thompson's Auto Repair is in Mesa, and he's been since 1970. Brian and Thelma own Thompson's Auto Repair, and I think they're the second or third generation of Thompson's that's been in the car repair business. They are the only repair shop in Mesa that Mark Salem says that you should visit. They're on Main Street just east of Stapley. They've been around a very long time. You only have to meet Brian and Thelma to know that they're exactly the kind of people you'd want as your neighbors, and you have to know, and you're going to look at them, and you're going to see it, and you're going to hear it, that they're as honest as the day is long. So if you live in Mesa and you're looking for a shop, may I suggest Thompson's Auto Repair. They're on a Main Street just east of Stapley on the south side of the road. Is it Brian? Is it Brian?
Yes.
Hi, Brian. Go right ahead, sir.
Yes. Hey there. Okay, 2006 Volvo XC90. Now, this is an issue I've already resolved and moved on, but I could sure use some feedback or maybe some peace of mind so I can learn from this. When we purchased the car, almost immediately I could feel under the pedal, and you reminded me this in your talk about the engine mounts, a vibration when accelerating.
Okay.
It did get worse progressively, and I had a mobile mechanic friend come and look at the car, and there was a engine mount issue.
Okay, Brian, we only have about a minute and 45, so give me what you can as fast as you can.
Okay, we replaced 4 out of 5 engine mounts.
Okay.
It seemed like it solved the issue. And within only a couple months, I felt vibration again. The top engine mount that we replaced was already shot, and it turned out there was another engine mount down there, the only one we didn't replace that was busted. In replacing all the engine mounts and the strut mounts, did I go overboard in trying to diagnose what actually needed to be changed?
Well,
or is there an issue with these Volvos that this is kind of common?
Well, there's a couple of thoughts. Number one, there's a lot of shops that are going to tell you if you're going to do one, you do them all. But like you said, all of them is a whole lot of money, especially if you've got four, five, six mounts plus an upper strut mount. Second of all, I don't know what the mileage was, and I didn't write it down, but it's an 06, so I'm going to assume it's high mileage. And I want to tell you that, yes, we are capable. Our industry is capable of diagnosing a specific mount. We are capable of doing that. As far as Volvo mounts being bad, I'm not aware of that being an issue. I am aware that I would be a little suspect to buy a non-Volvo mount because they are somewhat proprietary, but I've done that in the past. Mark at MarkSalem.com. Mark at MarkSalem.com. You want to continue the discussion? Meet me there.